others who are still outside to come in, and as soon as we are settled, all of us will have to proceed. And even those who are more far, they can come nearer because the sufficient is around here. It's best that we are where we can be visible rather than that far. All right. Honourable members, I will take you through the agenda for today, or maybe let me wait that we get settled. Okay, I'll take you through the agenda of the day for today. Today we've got one item which we prioritized, and we thought we're going to afford sufficient time to engage on that because it's quite diverse. It's got so many other things in it. And if you look at our agenda, it is that we have a briefing by the Department of Performance, Monitoring and Evaluation on the performance of government and its challenges from the 1st of April 2010 to date. I know on the agenda it's written state. Obviously state would be too huge for us to do an assessment. We will actually focus on the assessment of government and its challenges from the 1st of April 2010 to date. And therefore, because we had other interaction in the past with the department, we know that they've got a tool that they utilize in terms of evaluating and monitoring performance. We are going to take this time to go through that kind of an assessment, and as a committee we will be able to observe how far have we gone in terms of the implementation. And it will be good that it will amplify the challenges that we then need to zero in and ensure that during our process of oversight we therefore emphasize those points in order for them to be closed. Okay, I will just indicate the apologies that I have. I have four apologies. The first apology is from the Minister for Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, Minister Collins Shabane, who is outside the country. We've got also the Deputy Minister, Ayanda Ndlovu, Public Safety and Administration. The Deputy Minister is also outside the country. We also have the apology from the Minister for Public Safety and Administration on our government commitments. And we also have an apology from Honorable Adrian Williams, who is not well. Those are the apologies that are before us, which therefore means we can commence and proceed with our meeting. I can see that the slide presentation is already on from the department, and we do have the DG, Dr. Phillips, who is with us here, who is going to take us through the presentation. I will allow this opportunity and time for the department to take us through the presentation. We are also appreciating the DPSA, they are here, most of them, because most of the work is related, and as we normally work with the public service and administration, it is important for us to also take those matters that relate to the department, and all of you, Kenneth, are welcome as well. Okay, Dr. Phillips.
Chairperson, good morning, honourable members, colleagues and members of the media. If I first, chairperson, may introduce my team from the department. I have with me Mawazi Gasa, she's our Deputy Director General for our Outcomes Branch, and Batiswa Mapana, she's the Parliamentary Liaison Officer from the Ministry. As the chairperson indicated, we were invited to make a presentation on the performance of the state and its challenges. The presentation isn't actually going to cover the whole state in the proper technical definition of the state. It's going to focus on the performance of the three spheres of national, provincial and local government. You should all have a copy of the presentation and a copy of the midterm review. They were both in the front here. I'm going to talk to both the presentation and the midterm review. Before going into the detail of the presentation, I thought I should just briefly introduce the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation and our focus areas, because our presentation is going to be based on the work that we've been doing as a department. Since we were established in 2010, we've been looking at performance monitoring from three main dimensions. The first dimension being from the view of the government as a whole, strategic priorities. And in that regard, as you will be aware, we are focusing on the 12 priority outcomes and monitoring against the delivery agreements or plans for those 12 priority outcomes. At the second dimension, we are monitoring the quality of management practices in national and provincial departments and in municipalities. To date, we've focused on the quality of management practices in national and provincial departments. We're now piloting monitoring of management practices in municipalities, and we'll be doing that on a wider scale from next year. And then we're also looking at the performance of government from the dimension or from the perspective of citizens when they receive services at service delivery sites. And we call that our frontline service delivery monitoring. We also manage the presidential hotline, which is another source of information about the experience of citizens. And our presentation is going to include information that we've gleaned from all of these three dimensions of monitoring of the performance of government. The main source of information in the presentation is the midterm review. And the midterm review focuses on progress against the targets that were set in the delivery agreements for the 12 outcomes during 2009-2010. The midterm review presents a picture of progress up to the end of November 2011. So it's a little bit outdated now, but much of the findings in the midterm review are still valid, and as we go through the presentation here and there, you will see that we've included some more recent data than was in the midterm review. The midterm review was circulated to all members of Parliament several months ago after it was published in March of this year, and while I'm going to take some time to highlight some parts of the midterm review, we've structured the presentation on the basis of taking it that the midterm review has been read. So I'm not going to focus in too much on the details of the midterm review and would like to refer members to the actual narrative for more detail. We have deliberately made the midterm review, tried to make the midterm review a readable document. It's relatively short, given that it's a review of progress against the 12 key priorities. It's 55 pages, and and so it necessarily doesn't cover all the work that government is doing. It is an attempt to give a strategic high-level overview. And the midterm review was also produced with an intention of providing a frank and balanced assessment of progress, with the aim of contributing towards a culture of continuous improvements in government and accountable and transparent government. If you look at the midterm review document, you will see that it, for each of the 12 priorities, it provides an analysis of the problem statement for the priority as it was in 2009, an assessment of the causes of the problem, and then government's commitments to address those causes of the problem, and then a section on progress and challenges against the commitments, and then a section on the recommended focus areas for the remainder of the term. This midterm review document was produced through a very intensive consultation process within government, between DPME and all the various government departments, and it has been approved by Cabinet. It's therefore not an independent monitoring report. It's a report by the executive, and it's an assessment by the executive of its own progress against the targets which it set for itself. And given that we went through an intensive consultative process within government to produce the report, it means that the various departments accept the findings of the report and are busy now focusing on measures to address all the challenges which are identified in the report. The data in the midterm review and in this presentation is based on administrative data from departments. In other words, the data that departments collect administratively as they monitor their own work. And it also includes some data that we've obtained from national statistics. And we believe that this is the way it should be, because we don't want departments to be overloaded with reporting and monitoring requirements so that they spend too much time reporting and not enough time focusing on their work. So we're very cautious about duplicating monitoring and reporting requirements in departments. So we rely heavily on the administrative data which departments produce themselves. However, we are aware that there's a need to validate that data where possible, and increasingly over time we will be seeking smart ways to validate the data from departments without duplicating monitoring work by departments. You will see in the midterm review and in certain places in our presentation that we have started to do this. We are, for many of the outcomes, drawing data from a variety of other sources and using that to triangulate the data which is produced by departments. And as well as drawing on the midterm review, this presentation also draws on publicly available reports that we've produced on the quality of management practices in national and provincial departments and on the results of our frontline service delivery monitoring. Turning to the first area, the outcomes of education and skills. What I'd first like to do is refer to the midterm review. On page 3, where it starts on education and skills. The problem statement for education and skills was that in 1994, we inherited a fragmented education system with large variations in quality and effectiveness. And while much had been achieved between 1994 and 2009 in unifying the education system and skills system, in 2009, school performance remained a challenge. And the key challenge was that although education budgets had increased to around 5.4% of GDP by 2009, which is relatively high for a developing country, the increase in expenditure had not resulted in a marked improvement in education outcomes. So this was the key analysis by government of the situation in 2009. Moving down the page to the causes of the problem, causes of the relative poor performance against expenditure levels, which were identified included weak school management, low teacher knowledge, low levels of accountability of schools and schools management, and it was noted that those weaknesses in the basic education system were flowing through and affecting the post-school training arena as well, and that fewer learners were reaching matric and fewer still were achieving a bachelor's pass in mathematics, which was affecting the performance of the post-school education system as well. It was also noted that there was skewed enrollment in universities, which resulted in more learners in humanities, which meant that universities were producing insufficient graduates with the skills required by the economy. And low throughput rates at universities and FET colleges were also identified as a key problem. If you turn to the next page of the midterm review, the section at the top is what is a summary of what government committed itself to do in 2009. And these commitments are encapsulated in the delivery agreements for the education and skills outcomes. They included, for example, to improve education outcomes such that 60% of grade 3 learners would perform at the required literacy levels, that at least 60% of grade 9 learners would perform at the required mathematics levels, that at least 175,000 grade 12 learners would pass with a bachelor's pass by 2014. There was a commitment to establish a world-class system of nationally standardized annual national assessments, which would also be internationally comparable. There was also a commitment to make sure that all grade 1 learners would have received grade R before they entered grade 1, that the subject knowledge of teachers would be improved so that at least 41% of teachers would exceed minimum subject knowledge requirements, which is a step forward with regard to the situation as it was in 2009, and that there would be universal access to high quality standard workbooks to enable improved curriculum coverage. There was also a commitment to increase the numbers of adult entrants into ABET courses to 300,000 by 2014, and to increase the national certificate vocational pass rates from FET colleges to 50%. Further, there were commitments to increase the number of learnerships to 20,000 per annum, and the number of trainee artisans passing artisan trade tests to 10,000 per annum. And to increase the FET college pass rate to 60% by 2014. There were also targets set for the annual production of graduates from universities in order to meet key skills requirements, including in areas such as engineering, animal and human health, and teacher graduates. So turning to an assessment, the assessment in the midterm review of the actual progress against those commitments by the end of 2011. There's been very good progress in terms of the numbers of children benefiting from early childhood development. Grade R enrollment has doubled between 2003 and 2010, and it appears like the government is likely to meet its 2014 target of having all grade 1 learners having attended formal grade R. The reason why we say that is that currently over 90% of the relevant population of preschool children is already in grade R. So that we think that by 2014 it's very likely that that target of having all grade 1 learners having attended formal grade R will be met. Workbooks have been developed, as was committed, in order to assist learners and teachers to follow and complete the curriculum, and those are now have been distributed. The commitment to introduce a world-class system of nationally standardized and internationally comparable annual national assessments has been implemented. The annual national assessment system has been put in place, and the results are now coming out. There has also been very good progress in terms of increasing accessibility, particularly to poor children, and 70% of learners are now in no-fee schools. This is also a measure which assists with dealing with the problem of the dropout rate, which is affecting the unfortunately falling numbers of matriculants. So while we have a trend of an increasing pass rate at matric, we have a problem that fewer learners are coming through and completing their matric, which is partly related to the unfortunately high dropout rates, particularly at grades 11 and 12, which is about 12%. The introduction of the annual national assessments has confirmed the analysis in the midterm review and in the delivery agreements of the problem statements and the causes of the problem, and that the annual national assessments are indicating that literacy and numeracy levels are very low. The average 2011 ANA grade 3 literacy rate was 35%, and numeracy was 28%. Grade 6 literacy 28%, and numeracy 30%, which is pointing to a general lack of effective teaching and school management, including general weak district oversight of schools. There has been the Department of Basic Education is implementing various measures to address teacher quality, including various training programs for teachers. But the data that we have indicates that we're not yet meeting the targets that we set for curriculum coverage. One of the problems facing the basic education system is budget pressures due to compensation, which is related to the lack of implementation of national guidelines on compensation, and this is resulting in limitations on spending on other essential education services. In particular, the lack of implementation of the policy dealing with excess teachers is a major contributing factor to the budgetary pressures in the basic education system. With regard to post-school education, there has been good progress with enrolling adult learners in ABET, and the 2014 target is likely to be met in this regard. There has also been a marked increase in enrollment at FET colleges and a marked increase in the number of students graduating from FET colleges. However, a major challenge here in the context of the global economic growth constraints is that the percentage of graduate FET college graduates obtaining employment after graduating has dropped. That is partly related to the marked increase in number of FET college graduates, but it's also partly due to the fact that companies are not employing as much as one would have hoped. There's also been an increase in the number of unemployed learners and workers entering learnerships, and as provided in the detail of the narrative document, so far we are exceeding the annual targets in that regard. We're also exceeding the annual targets in terms of increasing the number of artisans that the country is producing. The target for 2011 was 10,000, and in 2011, we produce 11,335 artisans. So it's very likely that the 2014 target of producing 12,000 artisans per annum will be met. However, again, here there's a key challenge in that in order to finalize your artisan training and obtain a trade test, there's a requirement that you get workplace experience. And again, due to the economic slowdown and the difficult global economic conditions, it appears that there's been a reduction in workplace experience opportunities for learners, for learner artisans, and then initial employment for graduate artisans. regard to the targets for producing certain key skills from universities, there's been very good progress in terms of the training of teachers. The annual targets are being met, and it looks like the 2014 targets will be met, and also for honours and masters and doctoral graduates. But it looks like, for the moment, based on trends to date, it looks like we're going to be unlikely to meet the targets for graduates in engineering and animal and human health. The midterm review, as I mentioned earlier, is structured so that after analyzing progress and challenges, it then identifies key recommended focus areas which have been agreed on by government. These are the areas that government will be focusing on and is focusing on now in order to address the challenges identified in the progress review. In terms of improving the quality of basic education, there's a focus on strengthening the quality and coverage of early childhood development, improving literacy and numeracy levels in lower grades with the aim of addressing those very low ANA results, supporting teachers to be able to teach English as a second language at earlier grades, addressing the quality and performance in mathematics and physics earlier in the system. As we know from recent experiences in Limpopo and elsewhere, there's obviously a need to focus particularly on the issue of the distribution of textbooks at provincial level. The distribution of workbooks, which is done at national level, is in a much better state. There's also a need not only for the distribution of workbooks and textbooks to be done, but also for there to be an increasing focus on monitoring of the use of the workbooks in particular as a means of trying to ensure that the targets for curriculum coverage are obtained. There's a need also for much more detailed monitoring of issues such as teacher attendance to make sure that the target of teachers being in class teaching for 7 hours per day is met. And that requires more focused monitoring by both school and district management. The education infrastructure expenditure at provincial level tends to fluctuate to some extent. Some years it's better than others, but there's an ongoing need to improve supply chain management related to infrastructure delivery at provincial level in order to make sure that there's full expenditure of education infrastructure budgets in the context of the huge backlogs which are still there in terms of education infrastructure. There's also a need to focus on improving retention rates, as I mentioned, so that we can increase the number of learners and not only increase the pass rate, but also increase the actual number of learners matriculating. In order to try and improve school performance, there is a need for the ANA school results not only to be made available per pupil to the relevant parents, but also for the results per school to be made available both at a school level and district level, so that the school community, the parents and the rest of the school community can compare the results and the performance of their school against other schools, and so that there can be increased accountability for school performance to communities. DBE, the Department of Basic Education, is engaged in a range of interventions to address these problems and these focus areas. For example, we're working together with them to increase the monitoring of key indicators such as teachers being in class teaching for 7 hours a day. And there's increasing involvement of the National Department in textbook procurement and delivery systems at provincial level and in provincial infrastructure delivery processes. And there are various initiatives underway to improve school management. Turning to higher education, there's a need to intensify efforts to improve the quality of the qualifications provided by FET colleges in order to increase the chances of graduates finding workplace experience opportunities and employment opportunities. And here, the Department of Higher Education and Training is engaged in a range of initiatives to address these challenges related to the low throughput rates at FET colleges and the quality of the FET college qualifications, including the reviewing of the FET curricula, and also through the Department of Higher Education Training, the government is investing large sums of money into upgrading of the FET colleges and improving their equipment, and on improving the capabilities of FET college lecturers. A major area of progress in this regard as well was the signing of the National Skills Accord between government, labour and business as a step towards mobilising both the public sector and the private sector to provide more work experience and employment opportunities to learners on learnerships, to trainee artisans and to FET college students and FET college graduates. Turning to health. Firstly, I'd like again to go through the problem statement and the causes of the problem and the commitments in the midterm review. If you turn to page 9 of the midterm review, that's where the section on health starts. The problem statement indicates that we inherited a fragmented and inequitable health system organized along racial lines in 1994. Between then and 2009, numerous reforms were introduced and there was a net growth in public health expenditure. However, by 2009, significant challenges remained. Similar to basic education, the key challenge was that even though our spending of an estimated 8.5% of GDP on health was high, we had relatively poor health outcomes compared to other countries with similar or lower levels of expenditure as a percentage of GDP on health. When we analysed the situation in 2009 before putting together the delivery agreements, we identified a number of causes of the problem, including the high burden of disease in South Africa, the quadruple burden of disease, including high maternal and child mortality rates, HIV and AIDS and TB, high levels of non-communicable diseases such as high heart problems and diabetes, and injury and violence. And our analysis was that this quadruple burden of disease had put significant pressure on the health system. It was also recognized that there were considerable management challenges in the health systems, including challenges related to poor stewardship, poor intergovernmental coordination, and weaknesses with financial management and human resource management. The human resource management and challenges included a shortage of 80,000 health professionals. In that context, in 2009, and again this is all encapsulated in the delivery agreement for health, government committed itself to increasing life expectancy, improving maternal and child health, combating HIV and AIDS and TB, and strengthening health system effectiveness. A commitment was made to increase life expectancy at birth from 56.5 years in 2009 to 58.5 years in 2014. There were also commitments to reduce the under 5 mortality rate from 56 per 1,000 live births in 2009 to 50 in 2014, to reduce infant mortality rates from 40 per 1,000 live births in 2009 to 36 in 2014, to reduce the maternal mortality ratio from 310 per 100,000 live births in 2008 to 270 in 2014. Furthermore, there were commitments to reduce the mother-to-child transmission rate for HIV and AIDS from 3.5% in 2010 to less than 2% by 2014, to increase the total number of patients on antiretroviral therapy from 1.1 million in 2009 to 2.5 million by 2014, and to improve the cure rate, the TB cure rate, to 85%. There were also commitments to put in place the building blocks for a national health insurance system and to increase the percentage of the users of public health services who are highly satisfied with the services that they receive from the public health system on the basis of public surveys from 54% in 2009 to 70% in 2014. Turning to our progress against these commitments, in terms of life expectancy, there has been an improvement, and we think that this is largely attributable to the comprehensive response to HIV and AIDS, which has been introduced particularly since 2009. The latest life expectancy measurement by the Medical Research Council is 60 years, which is a significant improvement from the 56.5 years in 2009. However, life expectancy still compares poorly with other countries with similar or lower levels of investment in health. So while there has been a significant improvement in life expectancy, we still have room for further improvement if we're going to reach the kind of levels of outcomes per unit expenditure that are there in some other countries. We think that the reasons why our life expectancy still compares poorly with some other countries with similar levels of investment in health include the quadruple burden of disease, which I've mentioned, limitations with multi-sectoral planning management coordination related to those quadruple burden of diseases, and the impact of social determinants of health in South Africa, including poverty, poor nutrition, and remaining limitations to access to clean water and safe sanitation. There's also been good progress with regard to the target set for combating HIV and AIDS and TB. It appears that the number of people living with HIV is stabilized. There's been a marked improvement reduction in the mother-to-child transmission rate for HIV and AIDS from 8% in 2008 to 3.5% in 2011, which results in the protection of more than 30,000 babies per annum from infection. In addition, 19.9 million people have been tested for HIV between April 2010 to the time of writing of the midterm review, which was the end of 2011. And the number of people receiving antiretroviral therapy increased from 1.1 million in 2009 to 1.7 million people at the end of 2011. There was also a major breakthrough in terms of the procurement of antiretrovirals in that the introduction of strategic sourcing by the Department of Health nationally together with National Treasury has resulted in a halving of the cost of the drugs, which means that many more people can be treated within the same resource envelope. In addition, the numbers of people testing for TB has increased and the TB cure rate has improved. It reached the 70% mark in 2010, but there's still a remaining key challenge of high TB incidence and the high HIV-TB co-infection. With regard to improving maternal and child health, there's been improvements in immunization coverage. For example, by the end of 2011, we reached a 70% immunization coverage rate for diarrhea and pneumonia. There's been an improvement in the percentage of mothers and babies presenting for care within 6 days of birth. There's been an increase in the cervical cancer screening rates from less than 40% in 2009 to 57% in 2011. And the latest data indicates that there have been improvements in infant and under five mortality rates. The latest figures from the Medical Research Council indicate that the infant mortality rate has reduced from 40 per 1,000 births in 2009 to 30. And the under five mortality rate has reduced from 56 per 1,000 live births in 2009 to 42. We think that much of this progress can be linked to progress with the program of prevention of mother-to-child transmission and the improved distribution of antiretrovirals. There are remaining challenges related to maternal and child health. in terms of delays by community members in seeking health care and ongoing weaknesses in the management and the quality of the health care offered. Examples being poor compliance with clinical guidelines at health facilities, shortages of supplies and in some facilities, weak infection control in some facilities, inadequate emergency obstetric care and postnatal care, high levels of malnutrition and stunting among children, and varied performances in immunization programs in different districts. With regard to improving the effectiveness of the health system, substantial steps have been taken to meet the commitment to put in place the building blocks for the National Health Insurance System. And there's also been good progress towards establishing the Office of Health Standards Compliance. The data does indicate that there has been some improvement in patient satisfaction. The latest measurement is that patient satisfaction has improved from 54% in 2009, based on public surveys, to 60%. But we still have some way to go to meet the target that we set of having 70% patient satisfaction by 2014. And those challenges relate to remaining quality problems in the health system. The improvements that we have had so far, we think, can be attributed to national leadership in the health sector, in the development of norms and standards for the quality of service at health facilities, and a very hands-on approach from the National Department of Health in terms of engaging with provinces and districts and individual health facilities to actually audit whether or not those standards, national norms and standards for the quality of services are being adhered to. And the National Department of Health is actively working with the provinces, districts and facilities to ensure that improvement plans are put in place to address the weaknesses identified in the audits. There has been some progress with regard to meeting the targets for expanding primary health care. There's been progress in re-engineering the primary health care system and deploying health teams to communities, but there's still significant challenges which remain with the primary health care system, including shortages of health professionals and specialists, limited expertise in the coordination of primary health care amongst health professionals, and limited public awareness about the benefits of health promotion and prevention rather than seeking hospital-based treatment. With regard to the targets for improving the effectiveness, further targets for improving the effectiveness of the health system, progress has been made in that a national human resource strategy has been developed, linking intake into training and education institutions to projected demand for health professionals and skilled health workers. Training plans have been put in place to ensure that hospital managers meet minimum competency requirements. Regulations have been developed for competency criteria for managers in the health system, and a health leadership and management academy has been established. but there are still strong and significant weaknesses in the management of the health system. For example, with regard to financial management and supply chain management, particularly asset management and supply chain management, we know there are ongoing weaknesses due to the fact that only 2 out of 10 provincial health departments received unqualified audits in 2010-11, against a target that was set in the delivery agreement for 100% unqualified audits by 2014. We think the key elements of ongoing weaknesses in management in the health system include limited and inappropriate delegation of powers within the system. Often there isn't sufficient delegation to lower level managers. When I say lower level, I mean to managers on the ground in the health facilities. The managers in the system are also not using health information sufficiently to inform improvements in service delivery. And there are still problems at provincial level with poor human resource planning and high attrition rates of health and ongoing shortages of health professionals, and maintenance of facilities is an ongoing problem. The medium-term review identifies a number of areas for focus for the remainder of the term, including implementing a comprehensive information management system to track people on antiretroviral treatment to ensure that people to ensure that more people on the treatment remain on treatment. Further intensify the prevention of HIV and AIDS and TB rather than just focus focusing too extensively on treatment as opposed to prevention. To further focus on addressing non-communicable diseases such as heart conditions, injury and violence, and socioeconomic determinants of health such as poverty. And there the key issue is to intensify coordination and multi-sectoral work in that regard. To intensify the focus on child nutrition, to focus on implementing the improvement plans that have been put in place following the quality of service audits which have been carried out at facility level. To accelerate the training of doctors, pharmacists and nurses. To improve the performance of the National Health Laboratory Services. The National Department of Health, similarly to the National Department of Basic Education, is increasingly involving itself in the processes of related to expenditure of infrastructure-related funding at provincial level with regard to ensuring that the issue of under-expenditure on health infrastructure grants and inadequate maintenance of health facilities is addressed. And of course, it's clear from the data that we've presented that the health system is in the process of turnaround, and that some very significant improvements have been achieved since 2009, and it will be very important to maintain that turnaround momentum. Turning to the outcome of reducing crime and combating corruption, again, if we can turn to the problem statements and analysis in the midterm review, page 14 of the midterm review is where fighting crime and corruption starts. The key part of the problem statement is that despite the fact that levels of crime in general has started to decrease from 2003-2004 onwards, the levels of serious crime and violent crime remained unacceptably high in 2009. Similarly, a key challenge for government is corruption, which is by 2009 was increasingly undermining government's ability and resolve to deliver on its promise to offer South Africans a better life. The assessment of the causes of the problem in 2009 were that there is a complex array of causes of crime and corruption, including institutionalized violence, the culture of institutional violence that we inherited from apartheid, high levels of unemployment, high levels of inequality, and some evidence of breakdowns in traditional social fabrics. Again, as encapsulated in the delivery agreements, we made a number of commitments in 2009. These included to reduce the overall serious crime rate, to lower the rate of contact crimes, to make the criminal justice system more efficient and effective, to increase the rates of detection of contact in trial crimes. By the way, trial crimes are crimes such as burglaries, armed burglaries, and vehicle hijacking. To increase the number of parolees who have not breached their parole conditions, and to reduce corruption levels in government and in society. Turning to progress against those commitments, there has been some progress in terms of reducing overall levels of serious crime. By the end of 2011, the overall serious crime rate had reduced from about 3,900 to 3,680 per 100,000 of the population. There was also evidence that murder, attempted murder, carjackings, and house robberies had decreased, but there had been a marginal increase in business robberies. There was also evidence on the basis of public surveys that perceptions of the management of crime among citizens had improved. And we think that this success can be attributable, or could be attributable, to more visible policing, more effective police action and community vigilance, amongst other factors. There has been some improvement in the effectiveness of the criminal justice system, in that detection rates for contacts in prior crime are increasing. What that means is that when a citizen reports a crime, the numbers of those reported crimes resulting in cases going before court has increased. There's also been a decrease in the case backlog in the courts. There are statistics provided here in the slide about detailed statistics about progress with combating corruption in terms of the numbers of individuals who've been investigated and the numbers of officials who've been charged and convicted and departmentally charged. Given the fact that we've been exceeding our targets for reducing serious crime, we've been engaging as DPME with the JCPS cluster to encourage them to revise the delivery agreement and set more ambitious targets for the remainder of the term for further reductions in serious crime. There's also a need, in order to improve the criminal justice system, one of the key hindrances is the lack of coordination and integration between the ICT systems of the relevant departments involved in the system, which would enable cases to be tracked right from the beginning of the cycle or process to the end of the process. Much more focus is required to improve the finalization of court verdicts. In order to do that, there's an ongoing need to improve investigative and prosecutorial capacities, particularly with regard to tackling corruption. There's also a need for more focus on monitoring parolee reoffending and rehabilitation, to increase the involvement of perpetrators of serious crimes and rehabilitation in the prison system, to increase the tracking of reoffending by perpetrators of serious crimes released on parole, and to increase the involvement of victims in parole hearings. There's also a need for further focus on improving victim support. And the key challenges with regard to combating corruption, as I've mentioned, include improving the quality and number of prosecutors and investigators, so that we can secure more convictions in the courts. And there is still a need for further coordination. There has been some progress in setting up the anti-corruption task team, but there's still a need for further increasing of coordination amongst anti-corruption structures and government. Turning to the outcome on jobs. Again, if I can refer members to the problem statement on page 18 in the midterm review. The assessment in 2009 was that the key problem in relation to jobs is that in 1994 we inherited a problem of structural unemployment that goes back to the 1970s. And that employment declined in the 1990s and early 2000s due to slow growth and declining employment in gold mining and agriculture. Although there was a significant increase in employment during the boom between 2003-2008, even during that period, unemployment in terms of the narrow definition did not fall below 20%. And since then, unemployment has received another setback since the global recession and global slowdown that started in 2009. That global slowdown, which started in 2009, has not left us, and there's a real risk that it will continue, and that global growth will be slower in 2020 attain. There is a huge amount of uncertainty and risk currently in the global economy, deriving from unresolved issues in the Eurozone in particular. In 2009, again, as encapsulated in the Jobs Delivery Agreement, we made a number of commitments, primarily focused on increasing decent employment through inclusive growth. We committed ourselves to producing a coherent growth strategy, which would include a range of macroeconomic and microeconomic policy reforms. We committed ourselves to increase the labour absorptive nature of growth and to address the problem of youth unemployment, to improve the percentage of people at work to 45%, which is the opposite of unemployment. It's a focus on the number of people in employment. To reduce the Gini coefficient of inequality from 0.7 to 0.59 by 2014. To increase the income of the poorest 40% to at least 6.4% of total income. And to improve the overall competitiveness of the economy through various sectoral and cross-cutting strategies, and to reduce the cost structure of the economy. There was also a commitment in the short and medium term to counter the effects of the economic slowdown through expanding temporary public employment programs. Turning to progress against these commitments, unfortunately, whilst there was some increase in employment in 2011, that has since decreased again due to the global slowdown and disappointing GDP growth in South Africa. So based on current trends, we think it's unlikely that the 2014 target of 45% employment will be met. The latest measurement is that the employment rate is at 41%, which is the same as it was in 2009. We also haven't made good progress yet with regard to reducing the Gini coefficient and the share of the poorest 40% in total income due to the impact of the global crisis and also due to insufficient progress with regard to implementation of policies to reduce inequality, such as improving basic education and small business development. There has been progress against our commitments in terms of putting in place a coherent growth strategy. The new growth path has been put in place, and there's been stakeholder engagements and various stakeholder agreements in that regard. There has been progress with regard to the commitments to promote labour-absorbing growth in terms of development of industrial development strategies in manufacturing and mineral products, in terms of procurement reform, which is adding much more focus on local manufacturing, and in terms of the establishment of the Jobs Fund. There has also been progress with regard to the commitments to improving competitiveness and reducing costs, with the implementation of the Industrial Policy Action Plan, particularly in the areas of minerals beneficiation, automobile component manufacturing, the clothing sector, solar water heating manufacturing, and manufacturing related to renewable energy. There's been progress with regard to reducing communication costs in terms of the target of reducing the cost structure of the economy, but as we all know, unfortunately, this is countered by rising electricity cost prices in particular, and transport, freight transport prices, and commuter transport prices. There has been good progress in terms of addressing competitiveness issues in the economy with strong action by the competition authorities, particularly in the food production, fertilizer, and construction sectors. And there's been relatively good progress against the targets with regard to public employment programs, and that they have grown in volume and impact, particularly the expanded public works programs and the program and the various subsidiary programs, but also the community work program has increased substantially in size. again, focus areas I identified for the remainder of the term, including ongoing implementation of the new growth path and related strategies, work to address cost issues and reliability issues with regard to electricity and transport. We haven't made good progress with regard to our commitment to address youth employment, and there's an urgent need for decisions to be made on interventions in this regard. There's a need to put more focus on revitalizing research and development. There's a need to review SME support programs with a view to increasing their impact. And there's a need for more focus on the implementation of microeconomic reforms, which may be an obstacle to economic growth, including, for example, delays in municipal permits and building approvals and delays with obtaining work permits for skilled workers to enter the country. There's a need for further expansion of the community work program in the short to medium term. And there's a particular risk currently with regard to inequality in terms of the sharp rises in food prices. And there's a need to focus on measures to address the potential impact of those sharp rises in food prices. Turning to the outcome on economic infrastructure, the problem statement is on page 22 of the medium-term review, which was that since 1994, much progress had been made in accelerating infrastructure access to households in South Africa. In 2009, however, there was still some way to go in providing the bulk infrastructure needed to reach all citizens and to provide universal access to water, electricity, transport, and telecommunications. In addition, there were a number of infrastructure-related challenges emerging as a consequence of rapid economic growth, or relatively rapid economic growth, which had occurred, including, for example, increased vehicle ownership and freight transport volumes, leading to faster than expected congestion and deterioration of roads, railways, and ports. Migration and rapid urbanization were also leading to higher than expected utilization of infrastructure which had actually been designed for fewer numbers of people. And the rapid development of industry, commerce, mining, and agriculture had led to a higher than expected demand for electricity and water, which were exemplified by the power outages of 2008. So the analysis in 2009 was that there was clearly insufficient investment in infrastructure, that the country's economic infrastructure in particular was inadequate, characterized by backlogs and supply and demand imbalances. In addition, in many cases, there had been a lack of emphasis on maintaining and operating infrastructure efficiently, particularly infrastructure related to basic services, which I'll come to further just now. The lack of economic infrastructure in some areas of the economy had therefore become a binding constraint, limiting economic growth, job creation, and the attainment of higher living standards for South Africans. In 2009, our analysis of the causes of the problems included the dominance of state monopoly suppliers of infrastructure, a lack of competition, weak regulation, limited private sector investment, and a lack of incentives for dominant enterprises to become efficient in operating infrastructure. The commitments that we made in 2009, which are captured in the Delivery Agreement for Economic Infrastructure, include commitments to increase competition, to strengthen regulation, to accelerate the revitalization of infrastructure, aging infrastructure, and to ensure that major infrastructure projects are implemented, are properly planned and implemented to promote development and economic growth. There was a commitment to establish an independent system operator, separate from Eskom, to develop an integrated resource plan for the long-term energy mix for the country, to invest in renewable energy generation, or to facilitate investment in renewable energy generation, to reduce the backlogs in the maintenance of municipal electricity distribution infrastructure, and to monitor the implementation of ESCOM major build projects in particular to address the electricity supply shortage, which had been particularly experienced in 2008. There were also commitments to increase the rail market share of total freight from 177 million tonnes in 2009 to 250 million tonnes per annum by 2014, and to improve the efficiency of the freight rail system and to improve productivity at the ports. And also in that regard, similarly to the ESCOM major build projects, to closely monitor the Transnet major build projects to ensure that the infrastructure blockages to economic growth are dealt with. In the water sector, there were commitments to develop and implement new augmentation schemes and new regional bulk water infrastructure systems, to improve the maintenance of existing water resource infrastructure, to remove water license backlogs, and to improve the regulation, pricing strategy, funding model, and institutional structures for delivery in the water sector. There were also commitments to increase broadband penetration and to reduce information and communication technology costs. Turning to our progress against those commitments, the creation of the independent system operator is underway. Good progress has been made in that regard, in order to allow participation of independent power producers in the country's electricity generation system. With regard to monitoring of ESCOM's major build projects, the situation at the end of 2011 was that Medupi was a little behind schedule, but that Kusidi was ahead of schedule. But these still need to be monitored very carefully because there's still a risk of a deficit resulting in further blackouts until those two major power stations are on the grid. There had also been progress by the end of 2011 with regard to improving freight logistics. By the end of 2011-12, Transnet had increased its tonnage of freight on rail to 206 million tonnes. It had made good progress in terms of improving container terminals at the port. The Durban port re-engineering project was 90% complete, Cape Town 92% complete. Two container berths had been added at Mbura, and two more would be completed by March 2012. There's been good progress with the locomotive acquisition program at Transnet. And there has also been good progress from 2009 in terms of improving the national road network, although the issue of the affordability of tolls was coming to the fore as a challenge. With regard to water, there's been progress with water augmentation schemes, and by the end of 2011, 9 out of 25 targeted dams had their rehabilitation completed. There had been progress on reducing the water licenses backlog, but there had been inadequate progress on developing a new equitable water pricing and funding model, although over the past, since the midterm review was written, there has been more progress with regard to the issue of the equitable water pricing model. In terms of the targets related to information and communication technology, by the end of 2011, wholesale broadband prices had dropped by 73%. It was envisaged that local loop unbundling with different providers on the same telephone lines would start by November 2012, and we'd achieved 60% digital television broadcasting coverage. There was also good progress, which started in 2011, in terms of intensifying the monitoring within government of major infrastructure projects through the establishment of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, which has resulted in, for the major build projects in government's large infrastructure spend program, for a much more coherent picture of the planned projects to be produced for the project plans to be clustered, sequenced and prioritized into a proper project pipeline. For the remainder of the term, the focus areas will be the completion of the establishment of the independent system operator, the establishment of a single transport regulator, further focus on increasing private sector participation in rail and ports, ongoing focus on monitoring Eskom's build program, promoting cogeneration options, accelerating the integration of renewable energy, and accelerating demand-side savings, and particularly in the area of demand-side savings, we haven't made as much progress as we would have hoped. There will also be ongoing focus on improvements in port productivity, and finalizing the water pricing strategy and funding models and improved institutional arrangements for water infrastructure delivery and maintenance. Turning to the priority of rural developments, the problem statement on page 27 of the midterm review states that in 1994 we inherited a situation of a highly inequitable distribution of land ownership, with 87% of commercial arable land owned by white farmers and businesses. In 2010, an estimated 57% of the rural population lived in income poverty or had a monthly income of less than 570 rand. The percentage of the rural population living in income poverty had improved from 70% in 2006, but was still a very large proportion of the rural population. Rural infrastructure was also largely inadequate. We assessed the causes of the problem in 2009 to be poor infrastructure in rural areas, weak institutional support for rural enterprises, and weak social services in rural areas. We also noted that since 1994, the focus had primarily been on the demand for land reform, with inadequate attention to the use of the land once it had been redistributed, including post-settlement support and inadequate development of accessible markets and services for small farmers and other entrepreneurs. We also noted that the problems of poor infrastructure and poor access to basic services in rural areas are a result of weak and under-resourced rural local governments, as well as a lack of coordination between all the departments involved in service delivery in rural areas. We also noted that essential services are also generally less available and of poorer quality in rural areas, rendering those places unattractive for people to live and work. So there was a vicious cycle in rural areas of them being unattractive for people to live and work, which was in turn resulting in a lack of skilled people in local government in order to provide the essential services to make the rural areas more attractive. There is a delivery agreement for rural development which captures a number of commitments and targets relating to agrarian reform, improving households' access to food, improving the range of services available to rural people, and increasing rural job creation and strengthening rural local governments, and increasing the number of smallholder farmers. Turning to progress against those commitments, there has been some progress by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform in terms of introducing appropriate technology for service delivery models for remote rural areas, such as solar power and mobile clinics, but these need to be introduced more widely. The Comprehensive Rural Development Program has been implemented in its pilot phase, through which it reached 80 wards, although the cost per household in the pilot phase is quite high, and we identify a need to evaluate the CRDP, and that is in the process that evaluation is in the process of being implemented by DPME together with Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. There was progress between 2009 and 2011 in terms of land acquisition and redistribution, with 823,000 hectares being distributed to 20,000 beneficiaries during that period. 712 land claims under the restitution programs were also settled during that period. However, in terms of the overall target of transferring 30% of arable land to blacks by 2014, by the end of 2011, we'd only reached 27% of that 2014 target of transferring 24.5 million hectares. We need to be careful in terms of pursuing that target at the expense of paying sufficient attention to the utilization of the land once it has been transferred, and there are problems with regard to the underutilization of acquired land and post-settlement support. With regard to restitution claims, the remaining claims tend to be the more difficult claims, which are on high-value commercial farms in northern and eastern regions of the country and which are difficult to resolve. Some of the challenges related to ensuring that redistributed land is utilized relate to insufficient involvement of the commercial sector in assisting to develop smallholders and inadequacies or ineffectiveness with regard to the agricultural support which is provided. There are also questions which are being raised with regard to the effectiveness of the systems for providing financial support to small farmers. We are not doing well in terms of our target of increasing rural employment. According to data from Statistics South Africa Quarterly Labour Force Survey, they use a category in the Quarterly Labour Force Survey called tribal areas. And in 2009, unemployment in the tribal areas, in inverted commas, was 44%. And according to the latest data, that has risen to 52% in 2012. So there is alarming, it appears that in this Stats SA definition of tribal areas, there seems to have been an alarming rise in rural unemployment, which we think could be attributed to the slow rate of overall national economic growth, inadequate progress with regard to smallholder farmer development, and a lack of growth in employment in the commercial agricultural sector. With regard to our commitments to address rural needs in a comprehensive, more comprehensive fashion, there's a need to develop a comprehensive policy and strategy on rural development to achieve that more coordination around rural development. Ongoing need to strengthen rural local government, which I'll come to just now. With regard to agrarian reform and improving access to food, there's a need to speed up the restitution land transfer processes, increase post-settlement support to smallholders, increase emphasis on promoting subsistence agriculture, and we're going to need for the remainder of the term to put attention on the issue of rising food prices. There will also be ongoing focus with regard to rural job creation on the areas of agro-processing, mineral beneficiation, tourism, local procurement and environmental services, and there will be a focus on expanding the community work program, particularly in rural areas with high levels of unemployment. Turning to the outcome of integrated human settlements, the problem statement is on page 32 of the midterm review. Between 1994 and 2009, approximately 2.8 million subsidized housing opportunities were delivered. But in 2009, the assessment was that there were still 2.3 million households which were inadequately housed. There were still 1.2 million households in more than 2,500 informal settlements and 1.1 million households in overcrowded and underserviced conditions. There were between 400,000 and 600,000 households which did not qualify for the subsidy, but also could not access private sector housing finance. And the assessment was also that the state's new housing investments since 1994 have been unable to create more socially integrated neighbourhoods and to overcome the dislocation of the poor from economic work opportunities. Urban sprawl and low densities continue to contribute to unproductive and inefficient cities. We assess the causes of the problem to include the fact that the number of households had been growing at 3% per annum, which was largely due to reductions in average household size, as population growth had only been growing at 1%. There was a further cause of the problem was rapid rural-urban migration, resulting in a sharp increase in housing demand and a sharp increase in informal settlement growth. Early limits to the size of the subsidy provided had also pushed projects to the cheapest land on the edge of the cities. And improvements in the quality of the houses built and settlement designed since 2005 had inadvertently resulted in a decline in the number of houses delivered per annum because the cost per unit house had gone up. Against this background, in 2009, in the delivery agreement for human settlements, we committed ourselves to upgrading at least to upgrading informal settlements in 45 priority municipalities to benefit at least 400,000 households in informal settlements. The target was also set to stimulate growth in affordable home ownership through private sector loans to the lower range of the market and the rental market, and to inject 6,250 hectares of strategic state land, well-positioned strategic state land, to address the urban sprawl issue, to make that state land available for low-cost housing. There was also a commitment, in order to achieve greater integration in the planning of human settlements, to accredit municipalities to carry out the housing function. Turning to our progress against those commitments, with regard to informal settlements upgrading, by September 2011, 83,000 service sites had been developed in informal settlements, and at the time we wrote the midterm review, we were concerned that, on the basis of trends then, that we might not meet the target of reaching 400,000 households by 2014, but more recent progress over the last year with the upgrading of informal settlements indicates that we may meet that target of 400,000 by 2014, on the basis that by June of this year, 114,000 service sites have been developed, and that there's been progress with regard to putting in place plans for upgrading informal settlements in the other areas. With regard to the rental housing target, by the end of 2011, 19% of the target for rental housing units had been met, and there were a good project pipeline was in place, so we were of the view that that target for 2014 for rental housing would be met. There's also been progress with regard to accreditation of municipalities to carry out the housing function. At the time of the midterm review at the end of 2011, 8 municipalities have been accredited to level 2, and 16 municipalities have been assessed for compliance. At that time also, it appeared that we were on track with making state land available for low-cost housing projects. And in terms of providing more loans to the gap market, there had been good progress from the housing development finance institutions, but the housing department had not yet made sufficient progress in terms of recording the contribution of private banks to the gap market. So it was difficult to report on progress against the target of 600,000 loans to the gap market. The focus areas for the remainder of the term need to be more national support to provinces and municipalities with regard to the informal settlement upgrades in the 45 priority municipalities, the need to put in place a national rental policy that includes backyards and regulations and clear roles and responsibilities with regard to rental housing, an ongoing focus on the accreditation of municipalities to provide the housing function, conclusion of the transfers, the actual transfers of the identified state land for low-cost housing projects, and more monitoring of private banks' contribution to the affordable housing market, and more engagement with private banks to increase their role in affordable housing. Turning to local government and basic services, the problem statement is on page 35 of the midterm review. There was considerable advances in providing basic services between 1994 and 2009. But despite those improvements in services, there were unmet expectations of citizens with regard to basic services, and the backlogs remained high. In 2009, 46% or 5.7 million 46% of households or 5.7 million households did not have universal access to water, sanitation, refuse removal, and electricity. In other words, access to a basic and higher level of service in respect of all four of those services. We analyzed the problem to be that the process of producing integrated development plans, which had been envisaged to be the linchpins for facilitating local development and service delivery, had not been as successful as intended. We also noted the high correlation between poverty, poor services, and institutional weaknesses. In other words, the areas where the service backlogs tended to be worse tended to be in those in rural municipalities with high poverty concentration, and with weak local governments. And much of the problems with regard to basic service delivery relate to weaknesses in municipal governance and accountability in areas such as financial management, and are caused by issues such as skills gaps, high vacancies, and critical senior management positions. In 2009, again, as encapsulated in the local government delivery agreement, we set ourselves various targets for addressing these issues. We committed ourselves to categorizing municipalities according to their varied contexts and tailoring support to the specific requirements of the different categories of municipalities. We also committed ourselves to initiating board-based programs for sustainable livelihoods and particularly to improving the administrative and financial capabilities of weak municipalities. With regard to basic services, at the bottom of page 36 of the midterm review, we committed ourselves to increase access to water from 92% in 2009 to 100% by 2014, access to sanitation from 69% in 2009 to 100% in 2014, access to refuse removal from 64% in 2009 to 75% in 2014, and access to electricity from 81% in 2009 to 92% in 2014. Turning to progress against those commitments, with regard to water, by the end of 2011, the figure for access had increased to 94.5%, that is from 92% in 2009. But there are several caveats that we need to make with regard to this figure. The first is that this is a measurement of infrastructure being in place. In other words, it's a measure of communities and households' access to water infrastructure. The measurement doesn't take account of whether or not the water is actually coming out of the tap and the quality, and whether or not the quality of the water is adequate. There are problems with regard to the operation and maintenance of water infrastructure. And on the basis of those problems, we estimate that as many as 21% of the households which do have access to a tap do not always get water from the tap, and that 26% of households are affected by sanitation services and or facilities that are not fully functional. So while these access figures indicate progress, simultaneously we have a problem at municipal level in particular, where there are challenges with regard to the operation and maintenance of the infrastructure that has been installed, which are affecting the accessibility, the delivery of the accessibility targets, if it's measured in terms of both accessibility and functionality, as opposed to just the infrastructure just being there. The rate of delivery of water infrastructure has been slowing from 2009 as compared to pre-2009, and we think that that's due to a lack of bulk infrastructure as well as the lack of engineering expertise for maintenance and operation. But what is also happening in that in those areas where there are remaining backlogs, tend to be the areas where providing the infrastructure is most difficult, for example, in the most remote rural areas. And that's part of the explanation why there has been a slowing in the rate of delivery of infrastructure. With regard to refuse removal, the basic level of refuse removal access has risen from 64% in 2009 to 72% by the end of 2011, and it appears that we're on track to meet the 2014 target of 75% access to refuse removal services by 2014. With regard to access to sanitation, access to sanitation increased from 77% in 2009. The figure in the midterm review is an error. It's 77% in 2009 to 82% in 2011. But based on current trends, we don't think that we're on track to meet the target of 100% in 2014. This graph shows why we think that. The blue line in the graph shows the actual access between 2004 and 2011, and the red line shows the level of delivery which would need to take place in order for us to meet the target. So if you extrapolate the blue line on the trend that it's been going, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to meet the target with regard to sanitation. Similarly for electricity, this slide shows that although access to electricity has improved from 81% in 2009 to 84% in 2011, based on trends to date, we're not on target to reach the 100% access target of 2014. And that relates to issues of generation capacity, lack of bulk infrastructure, and lack of distribution networks, unless there's a market acceleration as indicated by the red line between now and 2014. With regard to our commitment to improve the administrative financial performance of local governments, whilst there has been some progress in terms of the number of municipalities which received unqualified audits, we think the progress has been insufficient in relation to the commitments. As illustrated by the 2010-2011 Consolidated General Report on Audit Outcomes of Local Government, which indicated that only 51% of all auditees received clean or unqualified audits, which is an improvement but is not nearly near the target that we set for ourselves. Also alarmingly, that recent Auditor General report on local government indicated that more than 70% of officials in key positions do not have minimum competencies and skills for those positions. So it appears that Operation Clear Audit has not had the impact that we had hoped that it would have. And one of the problems is that oversight and support to municipalities is fragmented and ad hoc, and that needs to be addressed. With regard to deepening local democracy, good progress has been made with regard to the establishment of ward committees since 2009, but more focus is needed on providing guidance to those ward committees to prepare ward-level service delivery improvement plans and to work with their municipalities to implement those ward-level service delivery improvement plans. With regard to the commitment to improve and increase the monitoring of performance at local government level, there has been some progress in that a tool has been developed by ourselves and DCOG and National Treasury for closely monitoring the management performance and service delivery performance of individual municipalities and to timelessly detect service delivery problems in municipalities. That's being piloted now in the current year and will be rolled out to municipalities with the poorest audit outcomes during 2013. In order to accelerate the delivery of basic services and get closer to meeting our target, our access targets for those basic services, there's a need to improve the national institutional arrangements for coordinating delivery of basic service, particularly on a sector basis. And a sector basis, I mean, for example, in the water sector, the sanitation sector, etc. We also need to improve our measurement methodology and our definition of basic norms so that it reflects whether or not the infrastructure is actually working as opposed to just the delivery of the infrastructure. And we need to pay particular attention to the 22 districts with the highest backlogs of these basic services. To strengthen municipal capacity, we need to increase the provision of planning and financial management support to different categories of municipalities and provide focused interventions to those weakest to the weakest municipalities. There also needs to be a strong focus on ensuring that municipalities fill senior management and key technical positions with appropriately qualified and capable staff. And there's a need for provincial governments to play a stronger role in terms of fulfilling their constitution and legislative mandate to support, monitor, and intervene in municipalities. Turning to the outcome on the environment, the problem statement is on page 40 of the midterm review. And the problem statement highlights declining groundwater reserves, declining water quality, and integrity of the country's ecosystems. It also highlights the problem of climate change. And in its analysis of the causes of the problem, identifies historic insufficient consideration of long-term environmental impacts and sustainability, and the country's past growth strategies, which largely ignored constraints arising from the finite character of natural resources, and the growth strategies which were focused on energy-intensive industries. It also identified the cause of the deterioration in water quality to systemic problems with regard to management of the water function related to poor institutional arrangements, insufficient capacity, particularly at municipal level, and poor use of incentives, disincentives, and regulations to address water quality problems. So we made various commitments in 2009 to address these issues, to improve the quality and quantity of resources, to increase the number of wetlands rehabilitated, to increase the numbers of rivers with healthy ecosystems, and to improve the capacity to treat wastewater by upgrading sewage and wastewater treatment plants and increasing the percentage of wastewater treatment plants meeting water quality standards. We also committed ourselves to increasing the proportion of power generation from renewable sources and to restore and rehabilitate degraded ecosystems, and to expand the conservation estate. Turning to our progress against those commitments, the water use licensing backlog has been significantly reduced. There's been a 74% increase in the number of water supply systems awarded the Blue Drop certification certificate by the end of 2011 by the Department of Water Affairs. There's been a progress with regard to the process of upgrading and improving wastewater treatment works, and the number of wastewater treatment works that scored more than 50% in the green and crop assessment has increased between 2009 and 2011. There's also been good progress with regard to increasing the percentage of renewable resources in power generation, and with the involvement of independent power producers related to renewable energy with regard to electricity generation. There's been good progress with regard to the installation of solar water heaters and with regard to increasing the conservation estate. For the remainder of the term, there needs to be an ongoing focus on the same issues, on the raising the quality of water and the improving the wastewater treatment plants, and various other issues such as amending the building regulations to promote energy efficiency, implementing more simplified environmental impact assessment processes for SMEs, and further consolidating the conservation estate and strengthening the National Wildlife Crime Reaction Unit to address poaching, including poaching of rhinos. Turning to outcome 11, which is a better South Africa and a better and safer Africa in a better world. The problem statement is on page 45. Which indicates that between 1994 and 2009, South Africa made a meaningful contribution to the development of Africa, but some of our objectives were not achieved. For example, we hadn't yet achieved as much economic benefits to our own economy from those efforts as we would have liked, and we hadn't made as much progress as we would have liked with regard to economic and political integration of SADC. We would have also hoped to have made more progress on the global front in terms of ensuring the countries of the North honored commitments they make to assisting developing countries. Again, we made a number of commitments. Including increasing market access for our products internationally, for our exports, consolidating the African agenda through intensifying our and the AU's contribution to regional and continental security and stability, to increase our involvement in processes, debates, and resolutions in the organs of the AU, the UN, and SADC, to drive and strengthen SADC economic and political integration, to reform institutions of global governance, and to increase our export of high-value added products to targeted economies to attract foreign direct investment and foreign tourist arrivals. With regard to our progress against those commitments, on slide 44, there has been progress in terms of integrating NEPAD into the structures of the AU, with the planning of key NEPAD infrastructure projects, including the North-South Road and Rail Corridor, the election of South Africa onto the AU Peace and Security Council, and the AU endorsement of South Africa's candidature for the non-permanent UN Security Council seat, and the recent appointment of Minister Dlamini Zuma as head of the AU Commission. There has been some progress with regard to regional integration in terms of consolidation of the SADC Free Trade Agreement, and there's been some progress in terms of reform of global governance institutions. In addition, inward foreign direct investment has been improving, as has high value-added exports and the number of tourists. In general, our focus for the remainder of the term, should be and will continue to be on the same issues as was the focus in the initial half of the term. Turning to outcome 12, and efficiency and effects of public service, the problem statement is on page 49, and that is that between 1994 and 2009, the focus was on integrating the various apartheid-era administrations into the new provincial demarcations and the allocation of powers and functions to the three spheres as defined in the Constitution. Between 1994 and 2009, there was also a major revamp and modernization of the legislative frameworks governing the public service, such as the introduction of the Public Service Act and the Public Finance Management Act, among others. And the aim of which was to increase the effectiveness, efficiency, responsiveness, accountability, and development orientation of the public service. In addition, between the periods 1994 and 2009, there was a marked improvement in the representativity of the public service. But in 2009, we recognized that despite those achievements, South Africa's public servants and the fact that South Africa's public servants were relatively highly paid and qualified compared to other middle-income countries, and the fact that departments were relatively well-funded, the public service was producing relatively poor results that did not generally meet the expectations of citizens. In many areas of the country, people still traveled long distance to access services, the quality of service was sometimes poor, and characterized by long waiting times, a lack of responsiveness, dirty and unmaintained facilities, slow turnaround times, and a lack of respect for citizens. In addition, corruption and maladministration threatened to undermine efforts to improve and expand service delivery. We analyzed the causes of those problems to be generally the key challenge being management weaknesses in the public services, including weak performance management and accountability mechanisms for civil servants, overly centralized and inappropriate decision-making processes in many departments, and managers not paying sufficient attention to the detail of the implementation of policies and plans. High turnover rates of heads of departments and senior managers were also identified as a contributing factor. And the fact that senior managers were often not paying sufficient attention to ensuring that basic administrative problems are addressed and that issues such as long queues and slow turnaround times at service delivery sites are addressed. It was also noted that while the public service had grown in size, there had been a loss of certain technical and professional skills in some areas, particularly in the health, education, and infrastructure management, and there had been a tendency to increase general administrative posts at the expense of professional and technical posts. The lack of a culture of continuous improvement in the public service was also identified as one of the causes of the problem. In addition, a further cause of the problem that was identified was a lack of strategic focus, with managers spending their attention over too many areas. In addition, weaknesses with regard to coordination between departments and the ongoing tendency of departments to work in silos was identified. So in this context, we made a number of commitments which are encapsulated in the Outcome 12 Delivery Agreement. There were commitments made to reduce the travel distances to access services by citizens, to improve responsiveness and turnaround times, to revitalize Bartupili, to ensure that all departments have service delivery standards in place and service delivery improvement plans, to improve compliance with the signing of performance agreements by senior managers, to reduce the average period to fill vacancies, to ensure that disciplinary cases are finalized within 90 days, to ensure that appropriate decision rights, in other words, delegations, are in place in departments, to improve financial management and the number of unqualified audits, and to deal with corruption effectively and develop the capacity of departments to carry out corruption-related investigations effectively and efficiently. In order to address the lack of strategic focus, we also committed ourselves to introducing a results-based and outcomes-oriented approach. Turning to our progress against those commitments, the outcomes approach has been introduced. The midterm review is evidence of that. and the delivery agreements. Well, and there have been some significant improvements in service delivery in some areas. For example, we all know that there's been a remarkable turnaround in the Department of Home Affairs, particularly with regard to the provision of passports and ID books. So, for example, by the end of 2011, the average time taken for Home Affairs to issue an ID book had reduced from 127 days to 45 days. And SASSA had also reduced its turnaround times for processing applications for social grants, and the South African Police Service had also reduced its reaction times. There have also been good progress in the health sector in terms of the audit of health facilities and implementing improvement plans in that sector. There had also been good progress in terms of filling of funded vacancies. Our analysis was that in 2011, less than 3% of funded vacant posts were vacant at any one time. But that overall general figure masks particular shortages of professional and technical skills in areas such as health and infrastructure delivery. The time taken to fill vacant posts improved between 2009 and the end of 2011 from an average of 9 months to 6 months, although the target for 2014 is 4 months. Progress has been made with regard to decision rights in terms of putting in place standardized financial and human resource management delegations. And some progress has been made in terms of addressing the supply chain management challenge in terms of issuing new regulations, and in particular with regard to the issue of non-payment of suppliers within 30 days. There was some progress in the Treasury introduced new prescripts in that regard towards the end of 2011. At national level, there was an improvement in the percentage of national departments receiving unqualified audits, from 66% in 2009-2010 to 74% in 2010-11. And there had been progress in terms of assessing the quality of management practices in departments, which I'll talk more about just now. The focus for the remainder of the term in terms of outcome 12 is to resolve the issue of the single public service, for an ongoing focus on service delivery and quality and access, drawing on the lessons from best practices such as the Department of Home Affairs, to continue to focus on ensuring that all departments have service standards and improvement plans, that performance agreements are in place and submitted, continuing to reduce the turnaround time on disciplinary cases, to ensure that not only the senior managers not only disclose their private interests, but also that departments verify such disclosures and carry out risk analyses to check that there aren't any conflicts of interest between senior managers and the work of the departments. There will be an ongoing focus on implementing the PFMA requirement to pay suppliers within 30 days of receipt of a legitimate invoice, on improving audit results, and on tackling corruption and making sure that anti-corruption hotline cases are resolved. Chairperson, that brings me to the end of the assessment of our progress, the progress of government against the 12 priorities. And what I'd like to do now is briefly go through some data resulting from our assessments of the management performance of national and provincial departments.
Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, I think we got the entire detail of the presentation. That's good work, Dr. Phillips. What I'm going to do now is that I'm going to afford you a 15-minute break so that you grab tea and come back for the remaining part, and then we can then outline the way forward. 15 minutes break for now.